session. Rather than reread the statement we read at the opening of the session this morning, copies have been passed out, so those of you who weren't here to hear it can now read it if you like, just sort of giving a general overview of the ground rules. We have been joined by the Register of Copyrights, who is sitting at the end of the table so as to only infect one of us. We're grateful that she's here, even in her diminished capacity.
Excuse me.
I guess we have the treat of having only four witnesses. Not that the more is not the merrier, but it will make for hopefully an easier afternoon to get through. Our witnesses are Alex. We have Alex Halderman from the University of Michigan, Blake Reed and Harry Certain from the Samuelson Glasgow Technology Law and Policy Clinic, and Stephen Metallitz, is it? Yes, from the Joint Commenters. I will read the two proposed classes that we will be discussing this afternoon. First, 8A, literary works, sound recordings, and audiovisual works accessible on personal computers and protected by technological protection measures that control access to lawfully obtained works and create or exploit security flaws or vulnerabilities that compromise the security of personal computers when circumvention is accomplished solely for the purpose of good faith testing, investigating, or correcting such security flaws or vulnerabilities. And 8B, video games accessible on personal computers and protected by technological protection measures that control access to lawfully obtained works and create or exploit security flaws or vulnerabilities that compromise the security of personal computers when circumvention is accomplished solely for the purpose of good faith testing, investigating, or correcting such security flaws or vulnerabilities. So we'll hear first from the proponents. Which of you would like to go first?
I'll go first.
Very good.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I am Alex Halderman. I'm a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at the University of Michigan. I'd like to begin by thanking you all for granting my request in the last rulemaking proceeding. The exemption you granted covering sound recordings protected by DRM that compromises the security of personal computers has provided valuable protection for security researchers and consumers to test, investigate, and correct these dangerous vulnerabilities. Today, we're here to ask you to expand this exemption to cover other classes of works where DRM presents serious security risks. We respectfully request exemption from the anti-circumvention measures for literary works, sound recordings, and audiovisual works accessible on personal computers and protected by TPMs that create or exploit security flaws. In the alternative, we request that you grant an exemption targeting PC-based video games protected by DRM that compromises the security of personal computers. Each of these exemptions would be limited, as we've said in our request, to cases when circumvention is accomplished solely for the purpose of good faith testing, investigating, or correcting such flaws. The same risks apply in these classes of works we're talking about today, as did in the sound recordings exempted in the last rulemaking proceeding. In the infamous Sony CD rootkit episode, Sony's DRM surreptitiously updated the user's computer to replace security components with ones that would provide more content protection. But these updated components provide weaker protection to the security of the user's PC. They created avenues through which hackers could gain unrestricted access to the computer and the user's personal data. 500,000 users were put at risk in the last in the Sony rootkit incident. Since that time, we have seen other prominent examples where harm was caused by DRM systems that were outside the scope of the sound recordings exemption last time. One case is Macrovision's SafeDisk product, one of the most widely used DRM systems for PC-based video games. It's so widely used that Macrovision contracted with Microsoft to ship a SafeDisk component with nearly every copy of Windows. But in 2007, malicious hackers discovered a flaw in SafeDisk that would allow them to bypass the computer's security systems. This vulnerability affected nearly 1 billion PCs, 2,000 times as many as the Sony rootkit. As bad as these problems were, many security researchers now believe that they're just the tip of the iceberg, merely highlighting security issues that are endemic to DRM products. There's often tension between the strength of DRM software and the security of the user's PC. That is for several reasons. One, DRM systems tend to be very complex, and complexity is the enemy of security. Two, DRM systems tend to adopt risky, often unsupported programming techniques, or like the Sony rootkit, techniques more commonly used by hackers. These are more prone than standard, well-supported programming techniques to cause security faults. And three, DRM systems tend to transfer control of the computer away from the user, putting it in the hands of the content providers or other third parties, for example, through mandatory automatic software update mechanisms. This is an invitation for attackers to subvert these mechanisms and turn them against the owner of the computer. These problems are compounded by the chilling effects of the DMCA's anti-circumvention measures. This chilling effect deters security researchers from investigating problems in DRM software because of the potential threat of lawsuits. As I detailed in my research plan comment, potential DMCA liability might occur in many scenarios that researchers could find themselves in while investigating the security of a DRM product. For example, DRM software is often designed to resist attempts to monitor and understand its behavior using standard software engineering and debugging and forensics techniques. To investigate and understand this behavior, a researcher like me wanting to investigate the problems would have to bypass these parts of the protections. Another example is that certain kinds of vulnerabilities that a DRM product have might only occur in portions of the software that were invoked during an attempted circumvention or after a partial circumvention of the product. So in the nooks and crannies of the program. To test all of these cases, a researcher would need to be able to reproduce those scenarios, circumventing those parts of the system. On the other hand, a malicious hacker, someone who actually wanted to attack a user, would have no qualms about doing this. Hackers are already not law-abiding, and so it's unlikely that they would be deterred from malicious behavior by the threat of a DMCA lawsuit. In past instances where DRM systems have caused security problems, such as the Sony rootkit, the simplest way for users to defend themselves has been to partially disable or remove portions of the DRM system. In order for users to do this, they need to circumvent part of the system. In order for researchers like me to develop and test such fixes so that we can help users help themselves, we also need to circumvent portions of the system. In my past research about DRM security, as a result of these kinds of necessary behaviors, I often spent more time speaking with my lawyers and discussing the potential legal risks than engaging in actual science. Several of my papers have listed more legal team members than scientist co-authors. That's not the way it should be. Even with the tremendous pro bono legal help of a number of different lawyers, I've had to perform this work at substantial personal risk due to the threat of lawsuits, like the lawsuit threat that I actually received from Suncom after exposing defects in their DRM system. Many researchers cannot make these sorts of personal sacrifices and choose not to study DRM products at all. We find evidence for this in the ongoing controversy over Sony's video game DRM platform called Securom. There have been anecdotal reports from users and others that the product causes security harms and other ill effects for consumers, resulting in a number of class action lawsuits that are pending. For months, this situation has been crying out for an investigation by reputable security researchers in order to rigorously determine the nature of the problems that the system causes and dispel this uncertainty about exactly what's going on. But so far, no such rigorous independent analysis has been published. And I believe the chilling effects of the DMCA are partially to blame. People have other things that they could be spending time researching that are interesting to them, that result in benefits to consumers, but that carry far less cost and personal risk. I have a tenure clock running. I have 7 years to establish a case for why the university should tenure me. And quite frankly, that for most junior faculty members involves trying to do as much meaningful research as possible in that time. If I have to spend twice as much time doing a research project because I have to stop at many points to consult with lawyers, or if I have to risk that most of the way through that project I'll find that I can't finish it because there would be an unacceptable level of risk, then that is a project that perhaps I should I would not consider repeating. DRM is not going away. On the contrary, it's finding new uses in e-book readers, high-definition Blu-ray discs, online music rental services, and streaming video platforms. It's likely to continue to see widespread adoption as long as it serves to enable new business models. The inherent security risks of DRM and its continued adoption make it inevitable that further security problems will be found in the next 3 years. But the question is, who will discover these vulnerabilities first? Will it be researchers who are seeking to protect consumers, or will it be malicious hackers who are trying to find problems in order to exploit them and damage the security of consumers' computers, as happened with the SafeDisk DRM system? Over 40 of the world's most respected security researchers have signed a comment in support of our exemption requests. They state that PC-based DRM technologies have presented serious security risks, that they are likely to continue to present serious security risks in the future, and that they are likely to present inherent security risks. Moreover, these 40 researchers, including people like Ron Rivest, Ed Felton, and Bruce Schneier, state that the potential liability under the DMCA chills security researchers acting in good faith from discovering and fixing such security flaws. Almost all software has security flaws, of course, but they're routinely detected and corrected by independent security researchers. DRM software, by its nature, poses an elevated security risk, so it's unacceptable that the DMCA's chilling effects exempt DRM from the same kind of security scrutiny as is applied to other software. The exemptions we're requesting today would help ensure that that security researchers are able to provide that scrutiny for a variety of DRM products in the coming three-year period. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Reed, you next?
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Blake Reed. I'm a law student at the University of Colorado and part of Alex's unfortunately large legal team. I'm here in support of Professor Halderman and proposed Exemption 8A, and in the alternative, proposed Exemption 8B. I'm also here on behalf of the Samuelson Glushko Technology Law and Policy Clinic, and joining me in that regard is CU Law Professor Harry Serdin, who's sitting to my right, but he won't be offering any remarks. In the interest of getting to the question and answer period, I'll try to keep my remarks relatively brief. Just to add a few things onto what Alex had to say. At the outset, I'd like to thank the Copyright Office for its continued consideration and accommodation of our exemption request throughout the proceeding and at this hearing today. We appreciate your attention to the details of the request. The chilling effect that Alex talked about is underpinned not only by explicit threats of lawsuit and implicit threats otherwise, but by an uncertain legal backdrop surrounding the existing statutory exemptions, in particular the security testing exemption that's enumerated in 1201J. In 2006, the Register stated that it wasn't clear that 1201J applied to the sort of security research behavior that is substantially contained within our proposed exemptions. Indeed, it wasn't clear in 2006, and there have been no developments that make it any clearer today. Now, we're not going to say that 1201J doesn't apply to this behavior. Indeed, we hope it does. If our exemption is not granted and someone like Alex is ever faced with a lawsuit, 1201J is likely to be the first defense to be raised in court. Unfortunately, we're simply uncertain whether it provides the sort of coverage that we would need to successfully defend what would otherwise be a claim of fair use. And in comport with the congressional intent for these proceedings, which is to fill gaps in the statutory exemptions, we think that an exemption would be appropriate, just as the Sony rootkit exemption was appropriate in the last proceeding. There's insufficient guidance for university and in-house counsel to provide the kind of sign-off for both professional and academic security research projects like the one that Alex has talked about under the cover of 1201J. So as conscientious citizens in the copyright world and the DMCA world, security researchers are likely to ask for that sort of sign-off, and they're not liable to get it. So accordingly, the uncertainty under 1201J forms a serious part of the chilling effect that Alex referenced. And that uncertainty is a sufficient basis, we think, to grant the exemption. There are half a dozen other statutory exemptions enumerated in 1201D through I. I don't think there's any serious contention that any of these apply to all of the behavior contemplated by this exemption. So I won't address any of them specifically unless you have questions about them in the question and answer period. But as a threshold matter, a lot of security research simply doesn't implicate any of these exemptions. And in the limited cases where it might implicate one or another of the exemptions, there's similar types of uncertainty to the type that surround 1201J. So again, I'm happy to get into that on the Q&A, but I don't think there's any contention that they apply. I'll conclude with a brief comment on the joint commentator's proposed limitations to the exemptions, if granted. Again, I won't address them all specifically unless they're specific questions, but to put on the record, we strongly oppose all of these limitations as written, as they would, in many cases, completely vitiate the exemptions as we've proposed. We don't believe that they're necessary to curb abuse. We believe that the language in the proposed exemptions as written is going to be sufficient to curb abuse, along with traditional remedies available in contract law and in copyright law. So with that, I will yield the floor and look forward to answering any questions. Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Patelitz.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. It's nice to be back here again on behalf of 9 copyright organizations that are listed in our submission and that are going under the moniker of joint creators and copyright owners. And I want to point out for the record, it's nice to be back here on May the 7th, 2009. This is 2009. It's not 2003 when Suncom sent a letter to Professor Halderman that he thought was a legal threat. It's not 2006 when this proceeding got deeply involved in the Sony rootkit situation, and there was a great, based on a very thorough investigation that Professors Felton and Halderman had already done about the Sony rootkit and some of the other techniques involved. So we're not in 2006 anymore. We're not in 2003. We're in 2009. We have to focus on now whether the prohibition on circumvention of access controls is substantially impeding non-infringing uses of particular categories, particular classes of copyrighted works. And we have to look at whether it's likely, more likely than not, if that's not occurring now, that it will occur sometime in the next 3 years. So I will try to step through some of those questions, as well as to respond to some of the points that have just been made. The questions that we've been going through for the last, now the third day of hearings, is there a non-infringing use that's being impeded? Is that use being impeded? And are there alternative means that don't require circumvention in order to carry out that use? The first question actually is a tougher one than one might think in the case of an exemption that on a subject matter that's already been addressed. If you look at pages 12 through 13 of Professor Halderman's submission, he gives two non-infringing uses. One is research. Let me get, if you'll indulge me, I want to get the exact language here. Engaging in good faith computer security research is number one. Number two, installing and utilizing the works. So what works are we talking about here? One category that was covered in the 2006 exemption, which of course expires on October 28th, and we're now considering these de novo, was sound recordings. I don't think there's any evidence in the record that any access controls are being applied to sound recordings today. Certainly, that's a vanishing breed. And so I don't think there's any evidence that that type of work is involved. We have heard, really, if you look at what's in the record, the only examples have to do with video games. And then I suppose the argument is that even if the argument for current interference with non-infringing use has to do with video games, then it may, or rather it likely will in the future, according to the proponents, involve some of these other categories of works. So if we go back to the non-infringing use, engaging in good faith computer security research, I am at a loss to understand how that involves a non-infringing use of a video game. Installing and utilizing the works, assuming we're talking about a video game, I don't think that the DMCA, Section 1201A, is preventing people from installing and utilizing the video games that they've purchased. So it's very difficult to see what non-infringing use we're talking about here. I think this is why perhaps the office stated in the 2006 decision that it is difficult to fit these issues into the framework of this proceeding. And I agree with that, and I think it's going to be even more difficult this time because the evidence is quite a bit different, quite a bit thinner, quite a bit more tenuous. But in any case, that's why we're having such a problem fitting this into the criteria that we're using to address every other proposed exemption that is coming before this proceeding. That is quite relevant to this issue that Mr. Reed brought up at the end about the statutory exemptions. And I'll come back to that later, but I think that is why this is so difficult, because we have statutory exemptions to deal with these with this general subject matter, and it's not satisfactory to the proponents, so we're looking at a potential exemption as well. So if we're talking about video games, let's assume that we have some non-infringing use, and I'm not sure, again, how it would be impeded, but let's look at the evidence that is in front of us. There are two examples given. One is SafeDisc. The evidence there is that researchers, for whatever reason, apparently did not discover this problem until after some bad guys discovered it, but they were able to very quickly do the research that was needed to generate a fix and have that widely distributed. Professor Halderman paints this episode in apocalyptic terms of the millions of computers that were infected and how much worse this was than the Sony rootkit. I don't want to underscore the obvious. There was no rootkit involved here. And if you look at the way the normal channels adapted to this to identify the problem, develop the fix, and distribute the fix, we give two examples of that in our submission, and that neither of them thought this was a world-ending problem. It was a problem, there's no question, and a fix was important. But the system worked, the research was done, and the security problem was solved. The other example, of course, is SecureROM. There that we have a lot of sound and fury. What it signifies is another question. I would submit to you there's far less there than meets the eye. There is no concrete evidence of any type of security vulnerability whatsoever. Now, it's interesting. Some people, among the numerous bloggers and commenters who have been complaining about SecureROM and how it's been applied with regard to particular video games, have raised some security concerns. That's quite marginal. I'd say it's a tiny percentage of the concerns, most of which have to do with why can't I install this on more machines or use it in more ways? Why isn't it more flexible? Perfectly legitimate consumer concerns, but not security concerns. One allegation, of course, was, well, this is another rootkit. And somehow researchers were able to do enough research into SecureROM to determine that it was not a rootkit and to get that information widely circulated. Again, I believe we cite this in our submission. So with SecureROM, I would urge you to read very carefully what the submission says and the follow-up submissions. And Professor Halderman is very careful not to make any assertions about any security vulnerabilities about SecureROM. He simply notes accurately that there are class action lawsuits pending, that a lot of allegations have been made. There's a lot of furor. There's a very toxic atmosphere surrounding it. And then he makes the assertion that the reason that this can't be cleared up is because security researchers are being chilled in their ability to conduct this research. Let's look a little bit at that assertion. Again, we're not talking about 6 years ago. We're talking about 2009. And we have Professor Halderman's sincere observation and belief that DMCA must be at least partly to blame for the apparent lack of fully independent research into SecureROM. I think there are a lot of other possible explanations for that. One might be whether anyone has ever asked to conduct this research or ever sought the cooperation of either the developer of the software or of the copyright owners that employ this software. There's no evidence of that in the record, and maybe there's something that's not in the record and will be brought forward today. But I think it's. I think you have some conclusionary, conclusory allegations here that somehow the DMCA has something to do with it. Clearly, there could be a lot of other factors at work, and Professor Halderman has mentioned some of them today, such as whether this is an attractive topic for security researchers that are seeking tenure. And whether he would have to, someone who would undertake this research would have to consult counsel. I don't think that the necessity to consult counsel is necessarily a non-starter here. It's not something that takes this type of research outside the pale. I think it's probably fair to say that the entire computer security field is becoming a bit more fenced around with law. There's a lot of legislation on this topic, and I'm not an expert on it, but I hardly think that the DRM situation is unique. I think it's also worth giving the same kind of scrutiny to some of the statements about security problems being endemic in DRM. That DRM is suspect because complexity is the enemy of security, because DRM has mandatory automated software update mechanisms, because DRM systems install a number of drivers in someone's system. Every single one of those statements is equally at least true of many other types of software programs. And I know everyone's always complaining about the complexity of new operating systems and trying to come up with simpler systems. I've installed software that has plenty of mandatory automated software update mechanisms, and I do hope and trust that they're not doing me any harm. And I've taken, you take steps to try to prevent that. But my point is that all of these characteristics that are attributed to DRM are also true of lots of other types of software. So let's turn to, we've talked about the as best we can about the infringing, the non-infringing activity and whether it's being impeded. Let's talk about alternatives, and in particular, look if you look at the research plan that Professor Halderman put forward, I think what you find that's striking there is how little of it actually seems to involve circumvention. It involves monitoring the operation of DRM systems and observing it. I think the first time it talks about circumvention is on page 3, when he says, look, we want to be able to reproduce these behaviors we want to have a number of instances running. And SecureROM only allows you, it's part of the DRM, it only allows you to install the game on a certain number of systems. I'm oversimplifying here because there are actually a lot of ways to increase that, but let's just assume that only allows you to install it on 5 platforms, and you need to run 15 or 150 instances in order to gain enough data to observe what the problems might be. Well, he says the most straightforward technical solution would be to defeat this part of the DRM so that the system would behave as if it had not reached the usage limit. But it is unclear as to whether this would violate the DMCA anti-circumvention provisions, and so they'd have to seek the advice of counsel. Well, with all due respect, if you need to run 15 instances and the DRM only allows you to run 5, you can solve that problem by buying 2 more copies. There's a very easy alternative that's available that doesn't require require circumvention. Similarly, a lot of the other points in the research plan involve observing what happens when, for example, fuzzing, sending some randomized packets, and you're observing what happens, how the system reacts to that. A lot of this, again, does not involve circumvention. Now, I'm not saying that nothing in his research plan would require circumvention. I'm sure he wouldn't have submitted it if that were the case. But I just think it's worth a careful read to see how much of a problem any limitations on circumvention might be in his carrying out this research. And I think that's relevant to this whole question of whether there's a chill in the air. Let me just mention briefly the question of the statutory exemptions. In 2003, the office said, where a statutory scheme exists for a particular activity, persons must utilize such statutory exemption to accomplish their goals or provide evidence why the statutory exemption is unavailable to accomplish a non-infringing use, not simply that the user could have accomplished his or her goal more conveniently by deviating from the congressional design. I think that was the right way to approach this and remains the right way to approach this issue of the impact of statutory exemptions. I think that viewed as a whole, if you look at the 2006 record, the office was confronted with what it appeared to it to be a very serious situation. I think that kind of comes through pretty clearly in the recommendation from 2006. And I believe it deviated from this principle, and it basically said, well, you tell us whether the statutory, both sides, tell us what you think the statutory exemption means and whether it applies. And because there wasn't a conclusive answer there, the office said, well, we don't think we're foreclosed from going ahead in this area, so we're going to go ahead and fashion an exemption. I don't think that's consistent with the statute. The burden is on the proponents to show every element that's needed for an exemption. And the very first element is to show that the activity that they want to undertake is a violation of 1201A1. If it's not a violation of 1201A1, then there's obviously no need for an exemption. And if it falls within a statutory exception or exemption, it obviously does not violate 1201A1. So although they haven't really addressed the subject, you know, I think these hearings have, like the hanging in Dr. Johnson's dictionary, has helped concentrate a lot of people's minds, and this is another example of an issue that never was really ventilated during 2 rounds of submissions, but we get here on May the 7th, 2009, and we now we're going to hear why Section 1201J doesn't cover this activity, why Professor Halderman can't bring his work within that exemption, and we'll look forward to hearing that and to responding to that after we've had a chance to study it. I would say it is not just 1201J, we cited a couple of other 1201G, I believe, and other provisions that might also be relevant here. But it seems clear to me that the design of this proceeding is that the burden of showing the inapplicability of a statutory exemption and the inability to bring your conduct within it falls squarely on the proponents, and they have not met that up to this point. Finally, on the narrowing issue, we did suggest some narrowing changes, which we'd be glad to go into if this is an area where you decide to recognize an exemption. I think the only, again, based on what's happening in 2006, the evidence in the record and anything going forward, I'm not sure how this could be extended beyond video games. But even if it were, we've made some suggestions which we'd be glad to talk about in terms of ways that this could be brought, we think, more closely into line with the previous type of exemptions that you've recognized. And, we'd be glad to go through those. A lot of them are the same types of drafting that we've suggested with regard to other exemptions. Let me just close with this. We've heard today that the Sony rootkit was the tip of the iceberg. And I suggest to you that sometimes what looks like the tip of the iceberg is just an ice flow. And it flows and it floats out to sea, it's never seen again. A lot of people in the industry, I think, have taken a lot of lessons from the episode of the Sony rootkit, and that's why I think you see such a sparse record today of any real evidence of security threats arising from DRM or from access controls. Of course, there's no way to guarantee that there are none, but we also know that we have an ecosystem in place, not only about DRM, but about all kinds of software, that relies on people in the field to identify and bring to the attention of the developers the flaws that may exist. We talk about this in the SafeCode example in our submission. That obviously is also applicable in the DRM area, but unless you're persuaded that what lies underneath that chunk of ice from 3 years ago is an iceberg, I think you have to rule against this exemption because the burden of persuasion will not have been met. Thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thanks. Let's first give Alex and Blake an opportunity just to respond to anything they've heard from Steve.
Great, thank you. It seems that Mr. Metallitz may be conceding that 1201J does apply to the behavior here, in which case, great. But I don't think we're here to litigate 1201J. That's a matter for the courts. And just as the last proceeding showed, I don't believe that the office needs to reach a formal conclusion on 1201J in order to grant this exemption. We think that uncertainty, as it constitutes part of the chilling effect on research, which is one of the statutory factors, is sufficient. Just to address briefly the 1201G exception for encryption research, some digital rights management simply may not involve any type of encryption. And for that that does, that exception contains a caveat that the research needs to be specifically tailored to advance the state of encryption research. And any kind of encryption research that happens to be tangentially related to security research may be not done with advancing the state of encryption in mind and may not succeed in that regard. And in fact, I think that's that may be pretty likely. Alex may have a little more to say about that. Finally, there's an assertion that this is not 2003 and this is not 2006. And the question that's brought to mind for me is what has changed to remove that chilling effect since 2003? And I don't think there's anything on the table that suggests that. And just to make this chilling effect clear, I want to read a quote from Suncom CEO Peter Jacobs when he was threatening Alex with a lawsuit in 2003. He said, "This cat and mouse game that hackers and others like to play with owners of digital property is over. No matter what their credentials or rationale, it is wrong to use one's knowledge and the cover of academia to facilitate piracy and theft of digital property." Let me read you another quote that's a little bit more of a recent example from the FTC hearing last month that I know Rob was a part of, from Debbie Rose for the Association of Competitive Technology, who represents the DRM industry. And she said, regarding pursuing this kind of security research, she said, hey, go for it. If you get scared by one threat of a lawsuit, well, there are lawsuits all the time. Just try it. The Electronic Frontier Foundation will pay for your defense. So I think that's the when we're talking about the chilling effect, there's that kind of rhetoric floating out there. So I think the suggestion that the threat of lawsuit has faded since 2003, I don't think there's any solid evidence of that. So I'll turn it over to Alex to address some of the other thoughts.
Thank you, Blake. Just a few things. We heard a question of whether this is an iceberg or an ice floe. I think that was the question facing the Titanic. And there's certainly ice in the water. There's certainly chilling going on. I would say that in granting these exemptions is certain to alleviate some amount of harm. I believe that it's going to alleviate a great amount of harm. If there is no harm, if there's no evidence of harm in the future, then there will be then I'll be proven wrong. But I don't expect that that's going to be the case, and neither do the signatories of the supporting comment from experts in the security community. A couple of other things. Talking about the, I think Steve mentioned the toxic atmosphere and the furor that has come out of the Securom uncertainty. All of this, these unanswered technical questions about what the software does, what ill effects it's having. These are very interesting questions for researchers about what the Securom software is doing, what harm is it causing, is there evidence that what evidence does it contain about just the general nature of security in DRM? All of these questions could be resolved quickly if people were able to study it, to study software like Securom without worrying about the threat of a suit. I could task some grad students on it, and we could have answers in a few weeks. Instead of it's been 9 months or something since the controversy erupted. And it's amazing. I have to say that if you want evidence of a chilling effect, I personally have been chilled from making this a top priority for my research group. This is not something that I've tasked people on precisely because I don't want to have to put my students at risk at this time. I think there was one other thing I wanted to address. Actually, I guess I'll take, I'll reserve the rest of our time.
Okay. Rob, you want scribbling questions?
A couple. I don't know if they're in any particular organization, but let's try. One of the questions that I think was raised by Steve was, or points made, that there it isn't clear whether permission has ever been asked for this, and maybe that would be a way of just clearing up all of the chill and uncertainty. Is that the case? Have you had, besides the threat in 2003, which obviously didn't need any further questioning, have there been other interactions and attempts to obtain permission to do what you want to do?
I haven't embarked on a permission request before, prior to any of the DRM security research that I've done in the past. It's generally not common practice in security research to ask permission because we worry that a regime of requesting permission before would result in a kind of selection bias that software makers who know that there are problems in their software and don't want them to come out would just routinely deny permission to experiment with their software, and software makers that really thought they had covered all their bases would gladly grant it. So it's not the general practice in research to seek permission. I would worry that if the requirement was the same to perform research on DRM systems, that we'd see exactly that kind of effect, that the systems that were that really had problems under the hood, like the Sony rootkit, would their makers would not grant permission readily, whereas software that was behaving well would.
So how do you respond to, at least in terms of, well, maybe you can explain a little, just to get to the encryption research exemption, that which deals specifically with encryption technology and examining scrambling or and de-scrambling information. That particular statutory exemption in 1201G does require that a person made a good faith effort to obtain authorization before the circumvention. And is this something, is and I address this to Blake too, to what extent does 1201G resolve or encompass the kind of research that you need to do, or in what ways is it too limited?
I mean, I have to go back to my previous response, and maybe Alex can chime in as well. Not all digital rights